From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I'm Paul Rykoff. I spent a year on the ground in Iraq, and there are soldiers in deep trouble in Iraq for refusing a direct order. Is it a larger problem or an isolated incident of equipment shortages?
19 members of an Army Reserve platoon are detained at gunpoint for refusing to obey orders in a mission they described as a death sentence. Their vehicles, they said, unarmed and ill-equipped. Then, as uproar continues over Sinclair's decision to air an anti-Kerry documentary, we speak with the vice president of Sinclair's corporate relations and indie media under attack. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, over two dozen Iraqis were killed in a series of bombings over the weekend, and the heavy U.S. bombing of Fallujah continues. On Saturday, five Christian churches were bombed, leaving 12 people dead. Nine Iraqi police officers were killed outside of Karbala Saturday. On Sunday, a car bombing in Baghdad killed seven, at least six U.S. soldiers were killed over the weekend, bringing the week's total number of U.S. soldiers dead to about 30. In Fallujah, the U.S. has released Sunni cleric Sheikh Khaled al-Jumaili from detention. He was detained for 3 days following the breakdown of peace talks with the Iraqi government. The U.S. and Iraqi governments are still insisting the Sunni leaders in Fallujah hand over the Jordanian Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, but they insist he is not in the city. Meanwhile, the U.S. military detained 19 of its own reservists late last week after they refused to carry out a mission of delivering fuel to a site north of Baghdad. One of the reservists left a message on his mother's phone saying, quote, "We had broken down trucks, non-armored vehicles, and we were carrying contaminated fuel. They're holding us against our will. We're now prisoners." After the story received widespread attention from the Army, admitted the reservists were still using an unarmored vehicle and released the soldiers, but they could still face disciplinary charges. Newsday's reporting, President Bush rejected a plan for a Muslim peacekeeping force to enter Iraq to help the United Nations organize elections. Bush reportedly nixed the plan because the special force would have been controlled by the United Nations instead of the U.S. Meanwhile, the U.S. is now asking Britain to move some 650 troops closer to Fallujah and allow them to be put under U.S. military control. Critics of the war in Britain have said the request is a pre-election stunt to assist President Bush. The Washington Post reporting the top U.S. commander in Iraq complained to the Pentagon last winter that his supply situation was so poor it threatened the Army's ability to fight. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez wrote in a letter to top Army officials, "The situation is so severe, quote, I cannot continue to support sustained combat operations with rates this low." Sanchez also complained that 36,000 soldiers were still waiting for protective inserts to upgrade their body armor. Meanwhile, the Knight Ridder News Agency reports the Bush administration last year failed to provide some 100,000 additional U.S. troops that U.S. military commanders originally wanted to help restore and reconstruct Iraq. In London, as many as 70,000 people marched Sunday against the invasion of Iraq in an event that marked the end of the European Social Forum. In an interview with the British TV network ITV, Kofi Annan charged the U.S.-led war in Iraq hasn't made the world any safer. He said, quote, "I cannot say the world is safer when you consider the violence around us, when you look around you and see the terrorist attacks around the world and you see what's going on in Iraq." Former employees at Guantanamo Bay have told the New York Times that detainees there were regularly subjected to harsh and coercive treatment that often amounted to torture. Near-naked detainees were sometimes shackled to the floor in freezing cold rooms, while soldiers shined bright strobe lights in their faces and blasted screamingly loud rock and rap music. Such sessions could go on for up to 14 hours with few breaks. One official told The Times, quote, "It fried them. They were very wobbly. They came back to their cells and were completely out of it," he said. The employees reported the harsh treatment quickly ended earlier this year after the abuses at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq became public. The head of the Republican National Committee has threatened to take action against the pro-voting group Rock the Vote and to challenge its nonprofit status if the group continues to discuss the possibility that the government may reinstate the draft. In an extraordinary letter sent last week that has received almost no media attention, Republican Chief Ed Gillespie wrote to the group and accused it of, quote, "promoting a false and misleading campaign designed to scare America's youth into believing that they may be drafted to serve in the military." Last month, Rock the Vote sent a draft notice message by email to over 600,000 email addresses. Gillespie described the possibility of the reinstatement of the draft as an urban myth and as proof cited a statement by President Bush there would be no draft. Gillespie went on to write, quote, "As a nonpartisan organization that enjoys the benefits of being formed under 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, you have an obligation to immediately cease and desist from promoting or conducting your draft campaign." In response, the head of Rock the Vote, Gemma Green, described the threat as a, quote, "textbook case of attempted censorship." Green wrote to Gillespie, quote, "By your logic, there should be no debate about anything you disagree with. There's a place for that kind of sentiment and your threats, but it's not here in our country." In campaign news, the New York Times officially endorsed John Kerry for president Sunday in an editorial where it described the Bush presidency as, quote, "disastrous." This brings the total number of papers backing John Kerry to 45, according to editor and publisher. Other major papers backing Kerry include the Boston Globe, the Miami Herald, the San Francisco Chronicle. About 30 papers have backed President Bush, including the Chicago Tribune, the Arizona Republic, and the Dallas Morning News. So far, 8 papers that backed Bush 4 years ago have opted to endorse Kerry. At one of those papers, the Tampa Tribune, the editors admitted they could no longer support Bush, quote, "because of his mishandling of the war in Iraq, his record deficit spending, his assault on open government, and his failed promise to be a uniter, not a divider, within the United States and the world." Bush is the first Republican candidate not endorsed by the Tampa Tribune in 40 years. The death toll from Israel's 2-week-long attack on northern Gaza has now left some 140 Palestinians killed, making it one of the bloodiest single operations during the 4-year intifada. Some 500 Palestinians were wounded, 80 houses demolished. Over the weekend, Israel announced the operation has ended. A new study by the Pew Hispanic Center has found the wealth gap between white families and African American and Latino families has widened considerably. In 2002, the median net income of white households reached $88,000, 11 times higher than Latino families, 14 times higher than African American families. The group found nearly one-third of African American families and one-quarter of Latino families are in debt. This compares to 11% of white families.
Breaking rocks out here on the chain, breaking rocks and serving my time. Breaking rocks out here on the chain, because I've been convicted of crime. I hold it steady right there while I hear it. Well, I reckon that ought to get it. I'm working, I'm working, but I still got so terribly far to go. I committed crime, Lord, I need crime of being hungry and poor. I left the grocery store man breathing when he caught me robbing his store.
get it. Been working, I'm working, but I still got so terribly far to go. Chain off the run. I'm gonna lay down somewhere shady.
Nina Simone, Work Song, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. 19 of a U.S. Army Reserve platoon were placed under arrest last week for refusing to obey orders to go on what they considered a suicide mission. Stationed at Talil Air Base south of Nasiriyah, members of the 343rd Quartermaster Company were ordered to drive a fuel supply convoy up to Taji, north of Baghdad. The soldiers had previously only focused on local missions in safer parts of southern Iraq and had never driven through Baghdad more than 200 miles away, where U.S. forces regularly come under fire. One soldier later claimed the chance of being attacked was, quote, 99%. On average, U.S. soldiers have been attacked 87 times a day in August. Over 1,100 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq since the war began. The platoon refused the order, saying their trucks were extremely unsafe. They said the convoy tankers lacked bullet-resistant armor and were not able to travel faster than 40 miles an hour. Some of the supply trucks were in disrepair and prone to breakdown, they said. And while the armed escort of Humvees and helicopters normally provided was not available. One of the soldiers later described the mission as a, quote, death sentence. The platoon's commanding general, Brigadier General James Chambers, admitted Sunday the unit was one of those whose trucks are still unarmored. In addition, the Washington Post is now reporting that Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, complained to the Pentagon last winter that the lack of key spare parts for gear vital to combat operations is so poor that it threatened Army troops' ability to fight. In addition to the high-risk nature of the mission, the objective itself was called into question. The jet fuel that the platoon was ordered to transport may have been contaminated with diesel and wasn't even usable. Some of the soldiers claim the fuel had already been rejected by one base and would be rejected again at Taji. After refusing the orders, the U.S. Army placed the men and women of the platoon under arrest. They were corralled in a tent, detained at gunpoint for nearly 2 days. During this time, some of the soldiers managed to phone their relatives here at home. In Alabama, Teresa Hill woke up to hear a recorded message on her answering machine from her daughter, Amber McClenney. On the tape, Amber says, quote, "I need you now, Mom. I need you so bad. Please help me. They're holding us against our will. We are now prisoners." According to the father of one of the soldiers, five members of the platoon were told they would be punished with a general discharge. Chambers said all 18 soldiers have returned to duty. The Army has begun an inquiry, and the soldiers could face disciplinary measures, including possible courts-martial. Paul Rykoff is our guest right now. He's executive director and founder of Operation Truth, which is a nonprofit set up to give voice to troops on the ground in Iraq. He served a tour of duty in Iraq from April 2003 to February of this year, stationed in central Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much for having me today.
It's great to have you with us. Well, can you respond to this latest story?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very critical story, and it should be getting the attention it has so far. Not only is it an issue because of the insubordination, but because of the larger problem. Right now, you're hearing about a National Guard unit or a reserve unit that's complaining about their equipment. This is one incident that's really showing how big this problem is throughout the country. I was there for a year. We did not have proper body armor. We did not have up-armored Humvees. We did not have ammunition, critical communications equipment. It just wasn't there. This war was really done on the cheap, and I think you're starting to see that come out now more and more.
I wanted to go to an excerpt of a documentary that we played, a year ago. It was rather a month ago. It was called Off to War. Mm-hmm. It tells a story of the Arkansas National Guard's deployment to Iraq. In April 2004, 57 soldiers from Clarksville, Arkansas, were sent to Iraq as members of the 239 Infantry of the Arkansas National Guard. Embedded with them were the brother filmmaking team Brent and Craig Renault. They're continuing to make this series of documentaries. And this is an excerpt of the documentary of the soldiers on their way into Iraq through Kuwait.
The convoy we're getting ready to take to Camp Taji, north of Baghdad, it's pretty serious. Some of the equipment is old, so we're trying to make sure it doesn't break down.
I have no idea why, you know, the United States Army would make us deploy with this old crap. And I think they're going to quickly understand that when half of it breaks down on the way to Taji, and it will, that it's not a good idea to deploy a National Guard unit with old Vietnam-era equipment.
This is what an armored vehicle should look like. The vehicle is totally armored, completely all the way around, even in the front windshields. This is the modern vehicles that the regular Army has right now.
We were promised up armor kits. We didn't get them. And so we're going to go ahead and try to fabricate something.
Hey, sir.
Yeah.
You think we could use some of this stuff?
We're trying to use as much of the metal as we can, but we only have a limited supply of it, so, you know, we have to resort to these old bulletproof vests. And honestly, I don't feel too comfortable with doing that, but we got to use what we can.
The sandbags will act to deflect the blast from a roadside bomb or deflect bullets if we're shot at.
An excerpt of Off to War, which tells the story of the Arkansas National Guard's deployment to Iraq. Part three of the series runs on Discovery Times on Saturday night. It's by Brent and Craig Renault, our colleagues at Downtown Community Television, where we broadcast from. Well, it's quite amazing to listen to this again, Paul Rykoff, because, in fact, they're talking about having to go to Taji as well.
Right.
And they're talking about the difference between how the Army is protected and how National Guard's people are protected. Can you talk about that?
Let me give you an example. When I deployed through Fort Stewart, Georgia, with my infantry platoon, you go through an area called the Central Issuance Facility. It's where you get all your equipment, your boots, your helmets, your flak jackets. And a transportation company from an active duty unit went ahead of us and got interceptor body armor, the ceramic plates, the top-of-the-line body armor we've heard so much about recently in the presidential race. They got it, and as soon as my first guy came through the line, the guy said, "Whoa, you guys are National Guard. I'm sorry. You can't have that. Here's the old stuff, the Vietnam flak jackets off the shelf." And I said, "Sir, you got to be kidding me. We're frontline infantry units. We need the best stuff you've got." And he said, "I'm sorry. We don't have enough to go around. You're going to have to deal with what we've got." And that was the inferior Vietnam era flak jackets that stopped next to nothing.
Right. Repeat the story and tell us who gets it and who doesn't.
Well, at the outset in the first invasion, active duty soldiers received priority on body armor. So my unit, 38 infantry soldiers and 40,000 other troops, went into Iraq without body armor, went into Iraq with the old Vietnam-era flak jackets, 40,000 people of the initial invasion.
And then we see in this clip, the soldiers are putting flak jackets on their trucks. They're not wearing them. They're putting on their trucks to protect them.
That's exactly what we did. I mean, you have to do the old Army adage of improvise, adapt, and overcome. And, you know, soldiers quickly realize that they're in this on their own, and they've got to try to come up with innovative ways to protect themselves. One of the things we did is exactly what they did. Use sandbags in the floors of vehicles, take old flak jackets and duct tape them to the sides of Humvees and troop trucks, and that's the way you protect yourself.
So what has been the response? And now you have, you're raising it in Iraq. You've come home to raise it on behalf of soldiers.
Right. Well, you know, it's been a constant battle. Somebody asked me on a radio show the other day if this was an urban myth. And you're seeing footage. You've heard the story. This is a fact. Our soldiers have been sent into harm's way with inferior equipment. It's a fact. And the government has been very slow to respond to these charges and these issues. And it's only started to respond because there's been pressure from the press, pressure from the families back home. But it's still not completely solved. There are reports of soldiers in Iraq without body armor. They're few now. But the armament of the vehicles, the proper firepower, and the overall number of troops are a problem in Iraq. And the administration right now is refusing to address them.
We have to break. When we come back, I want to ask you about this letter of Ricardo Sanchez saying last year that the troops were not properly equipped. I want to ask you about your ad, Operation Truth ad, that has just come out, and about this letter from the head of the Republican National Committee, Ed Gillespie, threatening legal action against the group Rock the Vote for raising the issue of the draft. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Steve Earle, home to Houston, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on more than 280 radio and television stations, Pacifica stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV and 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, Link TV. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org. Tell your friends about this public media broadcast. We are continuing on the issue of the troops, 19 of them, held at gunpoint for refusing to go to Taji, saying that they were not protected. Our guest is Paul Rykoff. He served in Iraq for almost a year, came back home, and set up an organization called Operation Truth. He joins us to talk about these issues, the letter from Ricardo Sanchez.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous. I mean, the draft is an issue that merits discussion. The letter from Ricardo Sanchez is critical because he's telling you, he's raising a flag saying, we don't have enough of what we need. You've heard this time and time again. General Shinseki, in the run-up to war, said we will need several hundred thousand troops, and he was squashed by the Pentagon. Military leaders throughout the Army, throughout the military, raised concerns at the outset and were crushed by people in the civilian administration who thought they knew better. And now these military leaders are proving to have been right all along.
How open is the discussion in the military?
Among the junior soldiers, it's very open. I mean, we're well aware of it. It's almost become a consensus. We know that, this is the situation, that we haven't been properly equipped. There have been steps made to improve it, but it's just an overall denial that the problem really existed. And it really does undermine the confidence of the soldiers on the ground. When you're walking a patrol and you don't have the adequate equipment, you don't have the proper body armor, it's a critical issue, and it makes you feel vulnerable. And it's absolutely unnecessary that a country with this much money and this many resources can forget to take proper care of the boots on the ground, the soldiers in harm's way.
The whole issue of Rock the Vote, of Ed Gillespie, the chair of the Republican National Committee, this has been reported almost nowhere, sending a letter to the organization Rock the Vote saying they better cease and desist talking about the possibility of a draft.
Right. Well, I'm expecting a letter from him pretty soon, too, because at Operation Truth, we're talking about the draft. And that's because we were there, and we have an understanding of how overextended our military is right now. And the draft may not be a possibility. It may not be a probability, but it is a possibility. It's a contingency that military planners have to consider. Any politician, any party who comes out and tells you, I guarantee there will not be a draft, is lying. What do you do if Korea comes across the DMZ tomorrow and Syria and Iran decide to get a cooperation and invade Iraq? We'd need troops from somewhere, and a draft is a contingency that we have to plan for, and we should, as a country, discuss.
I'm looking at this story in USA Today. Members of the military and their families say the Bush administration underestimated the number of troops needed in Iraq and put too much pressure on inadequately trained National Guard and reserve forces. The Annenberg election survey found 62% in the military sample said the administration didn't send an adequate number of troops to Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we've been saying all along. The troops have been saying this all along. But the hard part is getting this message out. One of the real downsides of the professional army is that when these soldiers are finished with their tours in Iraq, many of them don't get out and can't enter the public discourse. 55% of our troops in Iraq right now are there for a second time. That's why it's important that we listen to the troops and amplify the voices of those who've come back. That's why we started our organization, Operation Truth, and our website is optruth.org. You can find out stories from the people on the ground who've been there, that have been stifled, that have been repressed, and really need to get out in order to educate the American public about the most important issue facing our country in November and beyond.
What repercussions do the 19 soldiers face who said no to going to Taji, saying that they were unequipped, ill-equipped?
Very, very serious repercussions. They could be court-martialed. They could be jailed. It all depends on what the Army wants to do. I think that the Army will probably make an example out of them and really come down with the hammer because they want to say that this type of insubordination is not tolerated.
But yet they're back, supposedly. We're getting different reports on the job.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to hear much support for them for refusing the direct order. I mean, once you get a direct order in a combat zone, you are obligated to fulfill that direct order unless it's unlawful. Now, they may argue that they were under-equipped and they were trying to take care of their soldiers. And in the end, they may be, you know, sacrificial lambs in this story, and they may wind up being martyrized by it. But I think those soldiers on the ground were probably trying to do the best they can and trying to bring visibility to an issue that's bothered us all throughout the military, especially National Guard and Reserve troops.
Paul Rykoff, as head of Operation Truth, this organization got a lot of attention last week with the release of an ad. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about this ad?
Sure. It's a very powerful ad featuring Specialist Robert Acosta. Robert's 21 years old. He's from Santa Ana, California, and he lost his right arm in a grenade attack in Baghdad last summer. The ad basically tells Robert's story. It talks about how he feels about the war and tries to bring visibility to the fact that there are 7,700 casualties, wounded, who have not been on TV, who you haven't heard from, who have faces and are not just pieces on a chessboard or part of a video game. They're real people with real lives and real families. And I think it's a human cost of war that we haven't seen so far. And we're hoping it will wake the country up and provoke discussion, encourage people to check out more about our organization and have a discussion about the war.
Talk about the issue of the injured. We have been talking with Mark Benjamin at UPI, a pretty mainstream news media outlet, that his reports hardly get any attention anywhere else, and though he gets awards from the American Legion for continually covering the casualties of war, those who have died, but specifically those who have been injured, saying that there were more than 11,000 medical airlifts of soldiers out of Iraq, for example, and I'm sure the number is much higher right now. This issue of casualties, of people who are wounded, what do you understand at this point? You're saying now more than 7,000 what? What is the category.
More than 7,000 troops have been wounded as a result of enemy contact. Means they got shot, hit with a mortar, a roadside bomb. And Mark Benjamin's really been at the tip of the spear here trying to bring this to light. But there are tens of thousands of soldiers who have been injured, not the result of enemy contact. You fall off a truck. You get run over by a Humvee. There's a helicopter accident. And these are the types of injuries that are really not properly documented. They could be in the tens of thousands. They could be up to 30,000 right now. We really don't know. And the Army isn't really being honest with the American public about how many soldiers are being injured and wounded. And they're definitely not being publicized. You're not hearing from them. You're not hearing about their issues. And you're certainly not hearing about the VA and the underfunding of the VA, which is a critical issue right now, facing the 33,000 troops who've come home from Iraq seeking care in the VA hospitals.
Well, what about that?
Well, right now it's underfunded. Prince Sippy himself, who's the head of the VA, has publicly said, I have not had my budget met. I've called for a certain amount, and the administration has underfunded it. I think they're going to cut $910 million from the 2006 VA budget. They're cutting the budget and underfunding it as tens of thousands of troops come home from Iraq and Afghanistan. This administration's priorities are totally out of whack, and it's really unconscionable to treat our returning veterans this way.
When you do an ad like you did, where does it fit into the presidential campaign and election?
Well, I hope it causes America to focus on the human cost of war and understanding that this is the most critical issue facing our country. It's not some other pandering. It's not the Vietnam War. It's the Iraq War. It's the war where soldiers are dying and fighting in Najaf right now. We don't endorse a candidate. We don't want to endorse a candidate, and we don't even want to go down that route. We just want people to think about the war and educate themselves. Because after November 2nd, regardless of who wins, we're still going to have troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're still going to have wounded people coming back every day, and that needs to stay in the focus of people's minds. And that attention, that initiative that we have focused on November needs to carry past November and into taking care of our troops and their families.
Paul Rykoff, you're a former Manhattan investment banking analyst. How did you end up in Iraq?
I volunteered. After 9/11, I was on and off active duty with the National Guard and Reserves, pretty much waiting for the call. But when Iraq, this run-up for Iraq came, I knew I'd be going sooner or later, and I figured I might as well go in the beginning, get it over with, and be a part of the tip of the spear. After that initial year on the ground, I've come back, and now I'm still in the National Guard in New York. But it was out of a duty to serve. I wanted to give something back to my country. I wanted to lead soldiers in combat and try to give something back and also make a positive impact on the ground in Iraq. I knew that my 38 men would be a reflection of America, and I could, you know, help mold them and create a positive impression of our country to the civilians in Iraq and any other people we came in contact with.
The Democrats featured you in their weekly radio address. How did that happen?
Well, I had approached everybody when I came back, from radio stations to local politicians, saying that they needed to hear from people like me who had been on the ground in Iraq. You heard from plenty of policy advisors and wonks from think tanks, but you weren't really hearing from the soldiers. And the Kerry campaign was one of the groups that took me up on that offer and gave me a national forum to talk about soldiers' issues. And I pounced on it. I'm not even a Democrat. I'm an independent. But I felt like this issue was critical. And if they were going to give me a national platform to talk about soldiers' issues and the human cost of war, I was going to take it. And it really did start the ball rolling for this organization. Helped me galvanize other soldiers around the cause and create Operation Truth.
So this aired when? Right after the... this was on the anniversary of Mission Accomplished.
Exactly.
And for people who don't know, the Democrats' weekly radio address is simply the response to the president's weekly radio address. So what did you say on that?
Well, I was challenging the president. I mean, it was a year later, and when he declared Mission Accomplished, I was with my infantry platoon in Baghdad getting shot at. And the mission was not accomplished. We were not done. And there was a human cost to this war that really wasn't being given adequate attention. And our critical shortages... I talked about this way back in May. We hadn't had enough water. We hadn't had enough communications equipment. We didn't have the body armor we needed. And this war was really done on the cheap, and it was unacceptable, and it really disappointed me. I was disappointed in the president, disappointed in the administration, and I felt it was an issue that needed to have greater visibility brought to it immediately. I wanted questions answered. And when he told me at that time he couldn't think of any mistakes he had made, I was outraged. I could think of 20 I'd made since breakfast.
Paul Rykoff, you're an Amherst College graduate, your father an Army veteran, your late grandfather served in the Pacific Theater in World War II. Many people talk about those who go into the military today, since Ed Gillespie's so insistent on saying there isn't a draft, as an economic draft. What did you find when you were there?
Well, I mean, there is a socioeconomic divide in the military. I mean, the military is disproportionately middle class and lower class. Kids aren't leaving Beverly Hills or places like wherever Ed Gillespie lives and joining the Marine Corps or joining the Army. It's folks from places like Bed-Stuy or the south side of Chicago. And it's really a weight that's being disproportionately held by the lower middle class. And I think a draft is an interesting discussion in making people think about what is the cost of war and are you personally interested in sending your kid? I think creating that direct accountability, that visceral response among the public is important because people need to think about when they support a war, would I send my kid? Would I go myself? And there are a lot of people who are banging on the drum and hiding behind a desk in Washington.
Paul Rykoff, I want to thank you for being with us, executive director and founder of Operation Truth. Do you have more ads planned?
If we get more money. We're trying to raise money to air this one right now. People can help support us at optruth.org. It's been a real grassroots battle so far. We're trying to keep it going. We really want to crank the conversation up and make people think.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us as we stick with the issue of the media. Sinclair Broadcasting created an uproar last week when plans surfaced that it had ordered its 62 TV stations to preempt regular primetime programming in favor of airing the film Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal. The documentary is produced by Carlton Sherwood, a former Washington Times reporter who used to work for Department of Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge while he was governor of Pennsylvania. In response, 18 Democratic senators urged the Federal Communications Commission to investigate Sinclair's decision to air what they view as an unpaid 90-minute attack ad against John Kerry. FCC Commissioner Michael Copps released a statement calling Sinclair's decision to air the program an abuse of public trust. And some groups compiled databases of all of Sinclair advertisers so individuals could contact these companies and directly threaten to boycott their businesses if they did not pull their ads. Well, last Friday, I had a chance to speak with the Vice President for Corporate Relations for Sinclair, Mark Hyman. He joined us on the air while we were in Toronto doing this simulcast of the CBC's morning show, The Current, that's Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's morning show, together with Democracy Now! We did the interview just before we went on live with Democracy Now!, and this interview did air around Canada on Friday. I began by asking Sinclair's Mark Hyman why he decided to air the documentary 2 weeks before the election.
Well, I wanted to make certain I set the record straight. We probably all remember that telephone game we played in primary school where someone starts a story, went into the class, and it ends up being changed at the end. Except in this particular instance, this all came about, at least the controversy, if you will, based on a very deeply flawed article that appeared in Los Angeles Times. I think their adage must be, we want to get the story first instead of getting it right, which sadly kind of started a lot of the brouhaha, as we've made it clear on many, 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 many media outlets here in the last several days. We haven't finalized plans for this. What we want to do is investigate specific allegations that arose in this particular documentary. We don't know what the finished product is going to look like. What we do know is that we wanted Senator John Kerry to be a part of it, and that's why we quietly had invited him probably close to 2 weeks ago now to participate in this process because we wanted to examine what certainly were new revelations, new claims made by people who previously had not come forward.
Your argument when you told ABC affiliates not to air Nightline's program when they named the soldiers who died in Iraq was that it was too partisan. What is your response to those who are saying what you're doing right now, to say the least,
well,
is
obviously
partisan?
Well, obviously, that's an absurd comment. If you recall the Nightline issue, it was George Stephanopoulos on April 25th who made the announcement that Ted Koppel was going to do this tribute to coincide with President Bush's mission accomplished speech. He didn't say it was a memorial to recognize the fallen men. It was meant to embarrass the president, which is fine. When we first heard that comment, we called ABC News and we said, we'd like you to clarify what the intention is, because if you want to run a commentary, fine, just say it's a commentary. We're okay with that. If you want to tell people it's news, well, then we have concerns, because Stephanopoulos just told us 4 days or the day before, told America that it wasn't a newsworthy event. We further told ABC, look, if you want to run it on the anniversary of the war, that makes absolute sense.
And do you consider
Or we said, if you want to run it on Memorial Day, we will support this and we will definitely promote it. But to try to run it during the second night of the television sweeps rating period, and as Stephanopoulos mentioned, it was meant to coincide with the mission accomplished statement. This does not sound correct to us. Call it a commentary, we're okay with it, but don't call it news.
Do you not consider the deaths of 700 U.S. soldiers news?
Oh, absolutely. It's news. This wasn't a surprise to anyone. We know each and every day that people were dying in all of those. We reported those each and every day. So the question was, why did Ted Koppel pick out the anniversary of the president's mission accomplished speech as the one day to announce this when he could have done it 5 weeks earlier on the anniversary of the start of the war? He could do it a month following on Memorial Day, which certainly is the sort of the period that in our country that we say we always recognize our people. And of course, and Koppel dismissed Memorial Day as a weekend of keg parties and picnics. As a veteran, I kind of take exception to that characterization, but that's his view.
Let's talk about the man who produced Stolen Honor, Wounds That Never Heal, Carlton Sherwood, the former Washington Times reporter, Bush administration official, close friend to Homeland Security Secretary.
Stop, Amy. You got to be fair on this. Okay?
I want to let Canadians know who Carlton Sherwood is, and then you can respond. Sherwood claims not to be a political activist. He directed Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge's TV and radio operations when Ridge was the governor of Pennsylvania. And he, quote, recently has been tapped to create and manage a new federal website called firstresponder.gov, which is a key Bush administration public outreach program. Can you talk about the fact, how you respond to him being the producer of this program that you're telling all the affiliates, all of your Sinclair Broadcasting outlets to air?
Now, I thought I just made it clear a moment ago to your listeners, we didn't say we're running the documentary. You said it. The Los Angeles Times said it. The interesting thing is, we're complaining about a product that hasn't even been produced. It's like someone complaining about a referee's call in a game that has not yet been played. Kind of ironic. Maybe you watched the Minority Report movie too many times, but let's set the record straight here, and I want your listeners to understand this. This is the same kind of shoddy, cheap shot journalism that people embark on. Carlton Sherwood, so your listeners know, 33-year journalist, he won a Pulitzer in writing for Gannett at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's won a Peabody in television, the two highest awards, both in print and television journalism, as well as Emmys. Nobody in the mainstream press in America mentioned that. They mentioned that he worked for the Washington Times, 11-month stint, the shortest stop in his 33-year career, distinguished career, at major news outlets, including CNN, Philadelphia Inquirer, and everyone sort of forgets that he's perhaps one of the most decorated journalists in America. They try to cheap shot it and make him look like he's something he isn't. They also refer to him as a Bush administration official because he once worked for Tom Ridge when he was the governor of Pennsylvania. Follow this logic. And because now since Tom Ridge went to work for the Bush administration, they call him a Bush administration official. Here's the logic. Carlton Sherwood worked for Tom Ridge when he was a governor. Tom Ridge knows Fred Thompson, former senator, who also starred in No Way Out with Kevin Costner, who also starred in JFK with Kevin Bacon. There we go. We've just connected Carlton Sherwood to Kevin Bacon. The point I'm trying to make is cheap shot journalism can try to shoot the messenger all they want, and you're welcome to do that, but let's get back to the heart of the issue. This particular documentary, there were claims made by 13 American POWs, including two Medal of Honor winners. Their claims are very simple. They said John Kerry's 1971 testimony that he called an act of conscience didn't hurt anyone, and they're saying, not true. My communist captors walked into my cell and said, John Kerry, this Navy lieutenant, called you a war criminal. You're guilty of these war atrocities. Sign this confession or we will hurt you. They, as they had been doing for years, refused to sign a false confession. They were tortured. Those are the claims we wanted to investigate. These men ended 31 years of self-imposed silence because they wanted to respond to Kerry's claims that his 1971 testimony didn't hurt anyone. They're saying it did.
Mark Hyman, let me just clarify something. Are you saying you might not run this, that you haven't made your final decision?
We've never made a public statement about any of this. What we have been doing quietly, was we found claims inside this documentary. This is how it came to our attention, of 13 American POWs who made some very strong allegations that they specifically were tortured using John Kerry's 1971 testimony.
We
never announced anything. The LA Times The LA Times never spoke to our company.
So at this point, you're not requiring your 62 Sinclair Broadcasting affiliates to run this documentary.
We told them we're going to run a 60-minute program. We gave them a general time frame and a window. If John Kerry was to respond to us and said, you know, folks, we'll respond to you, and we'll participate, and I'll spend 2 hours with you. Guess what? We're no longer doing a 60-minute program. Maybe we're doing a 2-hour program. Maybe we're doing 2 1-hour programs over 2 nights because we think it's a valid issue. These men just came forward. Although, I have to tell you, we weren't the first they approached. They went to ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS first, who all dismissed them and said, we don't care about your claims.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think your past, you were talking about being a veteran, you worked for the CIA and Naval Intelligence, informs what you do now, both in your commentaries as well as pushing this project forward, if you actually do, in fact, run this documentary?
Correction, I have... probably a stretch. I wouldn't say exactly I worked for CIA. I worked for
CIA. I was just reading your
resume. I worked as a naval reservist, so I wasn't a full-time employee. I just want to make sure that was clear.
But you worked for the CIA in one commendation.
Oh, fine. Okay. I don't want to overstate it. That's all.
Reading.
The folks at CIA will hate me then, I guess. What respect? I mean, you know, news is what news is, and, you know, one of the advantages that I have, at least, is I've had the opportunity to travel to some pretty spooky places around the world and be in some uncomfortable situations. So that certainly gives me perhaps a little more sense of what's going on in third world countries that maybe the average American hasn't had personal exposure to. But the bottom line is for people to try to, I mean, if people want to demonize me, they're welcome to do that. My personal view on this is if demonizing me is what makes critics feel good, I'm okay with that because the worst that could happen to me, the worst day I could suffer through all of this, would beat by far the best day any of those POWs ever had. Remember, they suffered 84 years collectively of horrific abuse and unspeakable torture. And these guys, the few that have been active politically, actually campaigned against George Bush in 2000 when they supported John McCain, or they were active in 1992 supporting Ross Perot, a supporter of POW MIA causes, against Bush's father in 92. So these aren't Bush partisans. These are guys who have a track record of not supporting the Bushes. They just said, look, we don't question John Kerry's service. He did what he did. We're fine with that. It's just for him to say his testimony didn't hurt anyone. It hurt me because people hurt me seriously and physically when they beat me up and broke my bones because I refused to sign a confession that he said in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee I was guilty of committing these atrocities.
Mark Hyman.
Those are valid claims.
Mark Hyman, if the Bush administration were to win, would Sinclair Broadcasting do a little better? It's reached pretty much all-time low in its the stock trading at now $7 with the Bush administration's FCC chair, Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, pushing very hard for deregulation that would allow Sinclair Broadcasting to get more media outlets.
Amy, that's quite a Machiavellian view you have, but just think about it. If we really wanted to do this for some sort of nefarious reasons, we could just put that documentary on without any announcement and just run it. Or we could just run John Kerry's entire testimony.
If you could just answer that question in a more deregulated environment.
I am answering the question. You've got this conspiracy theory going on, and that's just not
would it help the company?
Would what help the company?
If President Bush were to win again, pushing harder for deregulation, which is what he is known for, with Michael Powell, chair of the FCC.
I'm not aware of the White House pushing for deregulation on the media front on anything. In fact, if you can point to one example, I'd like.
Michael Powell, and he has said it himself, is pushing much harder for deregulation. But we're going to have to wrap.
The FCC is an independent agency. Yes, he was appointed by the president, just like there are other members appointed by Bill Clinton on that same commission.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure. Give me a call whenever.
Okay. Mark Hyman, the Vice President for Corporate Relations for Sinclair Broadcasting. This broadcast on The Current, the CBC Morning Show, last Friday, brought it to you today here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, indie media servers seized and returned. We'll look at the crackdown on indie media, then go to a march that took place in Washington. Stay with us.
minds was one. Came into creation as itself, mankind was born. Step into the eye of the storm. Survivors pawn. Casualties of evil men. Sliding the blinders on. Lies are spawned. Hey, are you conscious what side you're on? Is the total story told or isn't they hide you from? Why we're on the brink of murdering more innocent? Now it's like we're patriotic and so militant. Get your ride on. Rise on. Take a look. They done even taken righteous laws. Rewrote the book. To benefit the prize they got their eyes on. Minds run round. Truth will be revealed when the proper time comes. Brainwashed. It's when you think how they want to think, speak how they want to speak, living in defeat, when you don't want to question what they teach, as the truth, with no proof, with the fear of burning in eternal heat, when you're programmed not to be your own man.
Brainwashers by Blackalicious here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The BBC's reporting, the FBI shut down some 20 sites which were part of an alternative media network known as Indie Media. A U.S. court order forced the firm hosting the material to hand over two servers in Britain used by the group. Indie Media says it's a news source for the anti-globalization movement and other social justice issues. A week later, the web servers were returned to Indie Media and their hosting company, Rackspace Managed Hosting. It's still actually not exactly clear who took the servers, the reasons for the seizure, or the legal authority under which they were impounded. Citing a gag order, Rackspace wouldn't comment on what had happened, both in the original seizure of the servers or their return. What this point is that the subpoena that resulted in the seizure was issued at the request of a foreign government. It's believed that the Swiss and Italian governments were involved in the seizure as well. Although initial reports suggested the FBI had taken the servers, the FBI, while admitting it, then retracted their admission of involvement. Indie Media and the Electronic Frontier Foundation are planning legal action to find out what really happened to the Indie Media seizures, the Indie Media servers. The seizure has come under heavy criticism from civil liberties and press freedom groups. Aidan White, General Secretary of the International Federation of Journalists, called it, quote, intolerable and intrusive international police operation against a network specialized in independent journalism that smacks more of intimidation of legitimate journalistic inquiry than crime-busting. We're joined by Devin Theriot-Orr, who is a lawyer and member of the Seattle Indie Media Center, working with the Electronic Frontier Foundation on the seizure. Welcome to Democracy Now! Devin.
Hi.
Hi, yes, it's good to have you with us.
I'm having some, there's some background noise on my line. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Well, if you could just listen very carefully, sorry about that. Can you explain what's understood at this point? First, we hear the FBI is involved. We even see Agence France-Presse quoting an FBI spokesperson say they were involved in the seizure. Then they deny it. French, Italian governments. What's going on here?
Well, we're still trying to determine exactly what's going on. But what we have been able to determine so far is that the subpoena was issued under U.S. law, most likely in the District of San Antonio, where Rackspace is, U.S. offices are stationed. So we suspect that, in fact, it was either the Department of Justice or the FBI that served the subpoena, but their involvement, that may have been the extent of the U.S. government's involvement in this action. But again, we're still trying to get all the facts, and since we have not yet seen a copy of the subpoena because it was filed under seal, it's somewhat difficult to determine exactly what happened here.
Now, have you had contact with federal authorities like the FBI?
Yes. On October 1st, two FBI agents visited my office in Seattle, Washington, where they were concerned. They said that they were visiting me on behalf of the Swiss government as a courtesy visit on behalf of the Swiss government, that in regards to a post on the Nantes Independent Media Center site of two allegedly of two undercover FBI agents, or not FBI agents, excuse me, of Swiss police officers who were, the photos were taken during the G8 summit and posted to the Swiss IMC site and then reposted to the Nantes site. And they said that they were concerned because there was personally identifying information on the website, and that there was some kind of threat on this post. After they left, I looked up the post in question, and we'd actually received an email from our ISP, Rackspace, a week earlier, around September 22nd, saying that the FBI had, you know, filed a request with them to have this photo removed. So we were aware of this incident, and the and Nantes had actually taken the proactive step, even though under U.S. law, I think it's very arguable that posting both the photos and even address information would be protected under the First Amendment. Just to be overly cautious, the Nantes site went ahead and masked the faces of these allegedly undercover police officers, and at no time have we been able to discover any kind of personal identifying information that was actually on the post. So that has not been factually supported at any time. But just so you know, on September 22nd, they've masked the faces of these people just to be extra cautious, and even you know wrote back to the ISP and said, you know, look, what, you know, we've done this. Is this okay? You know, we want to make sure that everything's okay. And then you know, lo and behold, on October 1st, the FBI comes knocking on my door and says, you know, we're concerned about this personally identifying information. I go to the site, and not only is there again no personally identifying information, but there's the photos have actually been masked at that point. So initially, when the servers were taken down October 7th, we initially thought that it was as a result of a Swiss investigation because of the proximity in time to the FBI calls on my office and the FBI email to Rackspace. As it turns out, that may not be the case. The Swiss government does say that they are investigating the posts, but that the prosecutor there has said that they are not, that they did not issue a request. They have said that to an attorney who's working with us in Switzerland. And then recently, we've learned that it may be. I mean, this is all still, you know, without seeing a copy of the subpoena, it's really hard to. It's all based on conjecture somewhat, but we believe that the Italian government may be involved, but we're still working on confirming the details of their involvement and trying to get to the bottom of exactly what happened here.
We're talking with Devin Theriot Orr, who is a lawyer and member of the Seattle Indie Media Center. So the two servers that were confiscated from Rackspace in Britain have been returned.
That's right. The servers were returned last week. Were again not. That doesn't, you know, solve any of the issues here, because you know the analogy that I think most aptly describes what happened here would be if the Swiss government was investigating a story in the Washington Post, and instead of contacting, you know, the Washington Post and asking them about the story, they get a subpoena and go to the people that publish the Washington Post and seize their all the presses in the publishing house and take all their back issues and then take it away without any kind of explanation or you know any kind of authority essentially for the action, and then just you know return it a week later without any explanation and say, okay, well, there, everything's fine now. So you know the fact that the hard drives have been returned is really a minor point for us. I mean, we're glad to have them back so that we can get our sites back up and running, but the point here is that it is a blatant violation of the First Amendment, and we believe that the U.S. government cannot aid and abet in a violation of the First Amendment, even if the FBI was not directly involved in even if they didn't have possession of the hard drives at any point. The point here is that the U.S. courts were acting in direct violation of the First Amendment, both in the sense that they were we don't know exactly what information they were syncing, but in the past, the kinds of stuff that they've sought has been server logs. So we've been involved with subpoenas being served on us in the past.
Devin, we only have a few seconds, but during the Republican convention, the New York IMC, Indy Media Center, was served with a subpoena for posting the names and the places where Republican delegates were staying. Not that that wasn't public information. What's the latest on that?
I'm not a member of the New York Indy Media Center, so I'm just speaking as a member of the Seattle Center. So I don't know if I can quite update you on what's going on there. I mean, I know that they're still looking into it, and that that we consider that information to be also protected. So I think this is a pattern of harassment by federal authorities.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us, Devin Theriot-Orr, lawyer, member of the Seattle Indy Media Center. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burks, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, Ryan Abernathy, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.